Malone, pass is deflected, going to be stolen, I think, by the doctor. Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
It is appropriate that Dr. J, the autobiography of Julius Erving, begins with these three words, rise, I jump. Above all, often literally, Julius Erving was known for the way he seemed to hang in the air as gravity pulled all the other basketball players toward the floor. Julius Erving joins me from WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's intriguing that you describe your very young basketball self growing up on Long Island in New York as the most coachable kid on the team, because aren't most people who saw you play as a pro likely to remember you as the ultimate freelancer?
Yeah, but freelance within a system. Ultimately, I think my skills as a basketball player led some of my coaches to give me a green light. And once you're green lit, it's like back to the playground. It's back to the playground. But we had plays and we had defensive schemes and, you know, we had all that. And Kevin Lockery probably was the best at it. He would say, man, the game plan is not working. Would you just go do something out there for us? And I would revel in that. I used to love it.
When did it first occur to you that you could fly?
Probably when I got to high school, and I dunked the ball in a basketball game as a junior, and I was one of the players who was coming off the bench, and I became a starter shortly after that, but there was a play coming down court, and, you know, nobody really dunked the ball except for the oversized guys in warm-ups, and I left from inside the foul line, and I actually jumped to, you know, kind of finger roll the ball into the basket, and I found myself over the rim when I got to the basket, and all I could do was throw it down. And it was my momentum that forced this play. So it was more like an act of God or something. It wasn't something that I planned, because, you know, I knew if it was something that I planned and I missed, I was coming out of the game. You know, the crowd went crazy. You know, the coach gave a sign of approval. And that was probably the first time I felt like I had flown.
You starred in the American Basketball Association, won two championships with the New York Nets before becoming the object of one of the most confusing contract squabbles that I've ever encountered. How did it happen that two ABA teams and two NBA teams all claimed that you should be wearing their uniform?
How much time you got? It was a little crazy. I mean, yeah, I'm playing for Virginia. I signed with Atlanta. I'm drafted by Milwaukee, and after one more year in Virginia, I end up playing with the New York Nets, which was more like a league-generated deal to keep me in the league, keep me in the ABA. So, mm-hmm. You know, I would play for their signature franchise, which was a New York franchise. And, you know, it's good to be a free agent, but I wasn't exactly free agent, you know.
No, the courts were involved with this.
Yeah, the courts were involved, and mediation was involved. And it was a mess, but we do sort it out in the book. I think we sort it out and we kind of make it work for the reader. So I won't try and elaborate on in depth and detail. We really don't have time for that.
You are candid in the book about your relationships with women. At one point, you say of your failure to be faithful to your college girlfriend, and again, I'm quoting here, it depletes my soul, this philandering. But it doesn't stop, this philandering, for quite a while after you offer that observation. Why not?
Mm-hmm. I think you go back to the beginnings. I mean, my first encounter with intimacy with the opposite sex, you know, happened during my elementary school years. And, you know, I was sort of persuaded by the girl. And then later, in early teens, another situation like that occurred. And maybe mom planned mother and father left that part out in terms of, you know, really having that frank discussion. And in the 50s and the 60s, I'm not sure if parents, you know, talk to their children a whole lot about sex and put you on the right path in terms of really appreciating the opposite sex, you know, for what they were and how they should be appreciated. And so I think when you get on the wrong path early, it's hard to get on the right path. And for me, yeah, it's one of those difficulties that, you know, I admit for the sake of helping to encourage others and advise others to really get a keen understanding, you know, before you deal with intimacy with the opposite sex about, you know, feelings and certainly about responsibility and about consequences.
Given that you played against Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and Michael Jordan, and you played with Moses Malone, it's fascinating that in the autobiography you say it's Pete Maravich who's the most skilled player you've ever seen. Make the case for Pete Maravich.
Well, the long, skinny kid with the floppy socks who just had the ball in his hand like a yo-yo on a string, and there was no string there. I mean, in terms of passing, nobody could thread the needle better. Nobody could see the court better and deliver a pass, whether it's orthodox or unorthodox. But, you know, when Pete was scoring 44 points a night at LSU and even with the Atlanta Hawks and the New Orleans Jazz, you know, he could step inside of half court and let it go. And you better believe most of them were going to go in.
My guest is Julius Erving. In the book, you write about the death of your son, Corey, who drowned after a car accident in Florida in 2000. He was 19. Was writing about that therapeutic for you?
Yes and no. It wasn't the purpose for writing the book, but as one of the takeaways after the book was written and now doing a book tour and talking about it, I feel some sense of relief. A lot of that period is a blur for me, and it comes across, I think, in the book in terms of that stage in my life, you know, not being as crystal clear as the earlier years. And, you know, I mean, I don't know what to say about it other than it's the worst nightmare for any parent or any sibling, and it happened to us.
In addition to your two ABA titles with the Nets, you went on to win an NBA championship with the 76ers back in 83. Larry Bird has often spoken about how he felt he and his Celtics teammates should have won more titles given the composition of that team. I wonder, looking back, do you feel the same way about the Philadelphia teams of that era?
Absolutely. At least one. You know, the initial team that we had in Philadelphia, if that team had stayed intact, because the team in its first year together, you know, had the best record in the league, went all the way through the playoffs, and then lost 4-2 to Portland, with them winning the last four games after we won the first two.
Mm-hmm.
So fixing that team, and maybe even staying with the coach, because he got fired the next season, would have given us a chance to redeem ourselves. And it was like starting new, and we ended up, you know, making the finals three times in the first 6 years that I was in Philadelphia and losing all three times. So I think that at least one of those times we probably could have secured a championship.
Must have been a gigantic relief to finally win that one in Philadelphia, though.
Yeah, it's year seven. And to have that happen, it was a tremendous relief. I had really felt a lot of pressure. And, you know, even made some statements that, you know, I have no thoughts of retiring. I'll play as long as I can, as long as I have to, you know, to bring a championship to Philadelphia.
In addition to your new book, you have a company that manages your various business interests. I'm curious about what's next for Julius Erving.
We will take the good ride, you know, from age 63 to whenever retirement seems relevant and, you know, worthy of undertaking, because that's an undertaking. And I think with the team that I've assembled and with the family that I have, since I have a young family, a daughter who's 8 and a son who's 12 and another son who's 15 at home. So as long as I'm raising them, you know, they got to keep me young and I got to give them the guidance that's necessary to go out and take on the world and make their own mark in the world. That's kind of like the priorities right now, certainly the family first and then what I do business-wise. And I will remain active in the public and as a strategic advisor to the 76ers, you know, I'll be spending a lot of time in Philadelphia.
With Carl Taro Greenfeld, Julius Erving has written Dr. J, The Autobiography. Julius, thank you very much for speaking with me. It was a delight.
Thank you. Mutual delight.
To see my review of Julius Erving's autobiography and read an excerpt from the book, please visit onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our intern is Zoe Sobel, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. We say goodbye this week to our technical director of the past decade, John Perotti's considerable technical expertise and good humor brightened many a long day at the office and the short ones as well, and we will certainly miss him. John joins NPR's Here and Now, which is great, albeit not the candy shop. So, this week's final word goes to outgoing technical director John Perotti. John, what do you have to say to the Only a Game staff?
See you later, jerks.
Pretty much the same thing he says every week, and it still kind of brings a tear to the eye, doesn't it? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. The Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, whose Health Policy Fellows program is in its 40th year. On the web at healthpolicyfellows.org. This is NPR.